League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there. League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, you guys, welcome back. So here's the thing. We've got some really exciting news. Something really cool happened. All right, just before Christmas, we did an episode called Surgeon from Another World, and it was about a book by that title about a man named George Chapman who did spirit healing with the help of a doctor on the other side named William Lang. And at the end of that episode, I told you that, as mind-blowing as that was, that it got even weirder because now, currently today, George Chapman's son, Michael Chapman, is doing spirit healing with the assistance of Basil Lang, who is the deceased son of the ghost who helped his dad. Are you with me? Anyway, here's my point. This is something that's going on right now today. So I told you guys at the end of the episode, go ahead, give Michael Chapman a call and set up an appointment. But it's not like I had done it. I really had absolutely no idea if it was actually even possible to see this guy. So here's what happened. One of my listeners completely blew my mind when he got in touch. His name is Dan Zetterstrom. And he happened to hear the episode the day it dropped. And he took the information that was in the show notes, the phone number and the email, and he got in touch with Michael Chapman and made an appointment for spirit healing. Okay? He already went. So he and his fiance, Elena, they went to visit Michael Chapman in Wales just a couple weeks ago. And then they called me up and told me the whole story about what happened. And I've got the interview. It's mind-blowing, and it's going to be on Patreon. We're going to drop it later this week. It's a Patreon exclusive. So if you've been thinking about joining Patreon, you want to support the show, go to patreon.com, jump on at the obsessed fan level, and check out this interview. It is pretty friggin' amazing. Okay, also wanted to let you know, tonight is the last episode of Season 2, and Season 3 will debut on Friday, April 25th, okay? But I want you to know there's going to be a couple of little surprise bonus episodes that'll pop up in your feed between now and then. So look for those. We won't be completely dark. And meanwhile, we are hard at work prepping Season 3. We've got some really cool books and more stories for you. And we'll be starting off Season 3 with Communion by Whitley Strieber. And then later, we'll also be talking about one of the newer books we've ever covered, a really eerie book from just a couple years ago called The Premonitions Bureau by Sam Knight. And it's so great. So if you haven't read it, definitely check it out. Finally, I just really want to thank you guys, the loyal listeners, because you make all the difference in the world. Look, your dedication to this show is 100% of the reason why we do it. And I'm speaking for everybody here. This isn't your normal podcast. And you know, content like this takes longer to create and produce than most other podcasts. It just does. And that's why we appreciate your dedication and your patience, because that's what makes it worth doing. And I will tell you that in the course of my 30-year career as a writer, this is the most rewarding creative endeavor I've ever been involved with, by far. And it's because of all of you. So thank you. You've changed my life, and your reviews and responses and reaching out has really taught me, after all these years, what storytelling is all about. Okay, so make sure to sign up for Patreon if you want to catch that interview. Keep an eye on your feed for fun extra stuff from us to you. And now for tonight's show. Here we go. Glimpses of Eternity by Raymond Moody Jr. with Paul Perry. Raymond Moody is a living legend in the field of afterlife research, and he has no more fucks to give. When you invent the term near-death experience, you have carved your own head into the Mount Rushmore of paranormal superstars. Sure, near-death experiences have always existed. He didn't invent them. But it was his game-changing work, Life After Life, Mockingbird Books, 1975, that dragged the phenomenon out of the shadowy halls of hospitals and hospice care centers and put it into the spotlight of modern medical research. In the last 50 years, near-death experiences have been studied, seriously studied, more than any other paranormal phenomenon, more than UFOs, more than haunted houses, even more than Mothman. Because of Raymond Moody, millions of people are familiar with at least some aspect of the near-death experience. It primarily happens to people who have been, at least for a time, pronounced clinically dead. And in case there is anyone listening who isn't familiar with NDEs, the experience itself can include such things as the sensation of the mind leaving the body, the sensation of being drawn into a tunnel, a bright light, a sense of peace, well-being, and unconditional love, a sense of having access to unlimited knowledge, the experience of a life review, a preview of future events yet to come, and encounters with deceased loved ones, or other beings generally identified as religious figures or beings of light. Sounds pretty cool, doesn't it? And it is. Most people who report having a near-death experience are permanently changed by it in a good way. They feel a greater love for and connection to other human beings. They have a decreased interest in the accumulation of wealth and material objects. They feel they've seen a reality that is more real than the one we all live in. Best of all, they no longer fear death. Because of Raymond Moody, by 1980, almost everyone on Earth knew what a near-death experience was, or was like, and how it made people feel. And in the years since, the phenomenon has become accepted to the degree that people tend to no longer question the existence of NDEs, but rather debate their meaning. And of course, the debunkers have been desperately trying to find some sort of physical cause to successfully explain it all away, but without much luck. The research continues and the stories pile up, and Raymond Moody is still called upon to speak all over the world as the preeminent authority on NDEs. A constant feature of the speaking engagements are people in the audience who share stories about their own NDEs. But very early on, within just a couple of years of the publication of Life After Life, something else started happening to Moody. People who didn't speak up during the lectures would nervously seek him out afterwards, in hotel lobbies and dining rooms, or outside lecture halls on college campuses. And they would awkwardly share with Moody a very different kind of story. Stories that made near-death experiences seem almost pedestrian in comparison. For the longest time, Moody recorded these stories but didn't really have a name for what these people were experiencing. Finally, the man who invented the term near-death experience was forced to invent a new term. Shared death experience. And that's what his book Glimpses of Eternity, Guideposts 2010, is all about. A shared death experience is when a healthy living person, in other words, someone who isn't on the brink of death, experiences a kind of secondhand NDE while in the presence of a person who is actually dying. They bogart someone else's death experience, as the kids might say. To illustrate, let's look at one of the stories from the book. Quote, "It was on my husband Johnny's 55th birthday when the doctor told us that he had lung cancer and maybe 6 months to live. I was beside him the whole time in the hospital and was holding on to him when he died. when he died, he went right through my body. It felt like an electric sensation, like when you get your finger in an electrical socket, only much more gentle. What happened was, our whole life sprang up around us and just kind of swallowed up the hospital room and everything in it in an instant. There was light all around, a bright white light. Everything we ever did was there in that light. Plus, I saw things about Johnny. I saw him doing things from before we were married. I saw him with girls when he was very young. Later, I searched for them in his high school yearbook and was able to find them just based on what I saw during the life review as he was dying. By the way, the life review was like a wraparound. I don't know how else to describe it. It was a wraparound scene of everything Johnny and I experienced, together or apart. There is no way I could even put it into words other than to say that all of this was in a flash, right there at the bedside where my husband died. Another thing that was strange about this wraparound was that in certain parts of it, there were panels or dividers that kept us from seeing all of it. I don't have words for this, but those screens or panels kept particular parts of both of our lives invisible from the other person. Here's another story, but in this one, there are multiple witnesses. The day my mother died, my two brothers, my sister-in-law, and I were all in the same room. None of us were really upset in the moment because mother had been on a long downhill course and we knew this. Suddenly, a bright light appeared in the room. My first thought was that it was a reflection shining through the window from a vehicle passing outside, but even as I thought that, I knew it wasn't true because this was not any kind of light on this earth. I nudged my sister to see if she saw it too, and when I looked at her, her eyes were as big as saucers. At the same time, I saw my brother literally gasp. Everyone saw it together, and for a little while, we were frightened. At that moment, the bright light seemed to gather around and shape up into an entranceway. The light looked a bit like a cloud, but that's only a comparison. We saw my mother lift up out of her body and go through that entranceway. Being by the entranceway, incidentally, was a feeling of complete joy. My brother called it a chorus of joyful feelings. And my sister said that she heard beautiful music, although none of the rest of us did. The lights were so vivid, we had no choice but to tell our story to the hospice nurse. She listened and then told us that she knew of similar things happening and that it was not uncommon for the dying process to encompass people nearby. Here's another one. A woman from San Diego told Dr. Moody this story, quote, "When my 15-year-old son died, I was there in the room with him. He had diabetes from a very young age, and of course, that greatly complicated his life. Because of the dependence that diabetes creates, my son and I were exceptionally close. I was holding his hand when he died, and I felt the life force surge from him, somewhat like an electric current, although vibration might be a more appropriate term. The shape of the room changed all at once, and instead of the hospital room, there was a field of intense light, far away brighter than anything anyone can imagine who's not seen it for themselves. In place of the hospital room and the medical equipment, a vision appeared of everything my son had ever done in his brief life. He was there, right in the middle of it, beaming, a bright smile of joy. I know that this is inconceivable for others, but as sad as I was to lose him, I felt the joy of his release from the constant discomfort and concern of the diabetes. It was just his time, is the best way I can describe it. I saw my son leave his body and enter into this intense bright light in which he and I were surrounded by scenes of his life, down to the smallest details. I saw many things I had long since forgotten, and also things I had never known about at all. I saw him alone in his room playing with his Fort Apache set, for example, or talking on the phone with his friends when he was a teenager. You could say that the scenes from his life were flashes or almost electrical discharges. Parts of my son's life and our interaction were blurred out, like the views you see on TV when they're trying to conceal someone's face. There's no feeling that anything bad was being concealed, however, only that this was not the occasion for it to surface. I chose these three examples because not only do they cover many of what Moody has identified as, quote, the seven common components of the shared death experience, but they also include things that are specifically not associated with near-death experiences at all, making the shared death experience a unique and separate phenomenon. The first of these, which I find fascinating, is the reports of, quote, the room changing shape. This gets reported a lot. Not the room disappeared, but the room changed shape. What the fuck is that about? I have never heard a person who has had a near-death experience report this detail in any way. The second is the aspect of the life review that involves panels, dividers, or sections being blurred out. Okay, so let's think on this for a second. People who have a near-death experience report seeing every single moment of their life replayed before them. Even spirits who come through during mediumistic sessions report that the life review was one of the first things that happened to them after they died. But none of them have ever mentioned any part of their life being concealed from them. But apparently in a shared-death experience, the non-dying person will be denied certain information. Certain events will be blocked from their view. Now, why would this be? Well, perhaps because they're still alive. Their story is ongoing. They have more things to experience from their own unique point of view, and there are certain things that for some reason they're not allowed to see regarding the lives of the person they're losing. So here's my question. Why the dividers? Why are things blurred out? Why are they not simply not shown at all, just edited out? Is this not possible? Is it important to know that information is being withheld? And what is the nature of this kind of information download that makes a certain kind of editorial choice unavailable, but does allow a weird kind of bleeping out of certain information? That someone, or something, some guiding force, God, whatever you want to call it, doesn't want you to see. You can't edit it out. You have to run the whole tape, but you can bleep stuff, block stuff, redact stuff. This is weird. I would imagine that I would be very uncomfortable if, for instance, Susan was dying and I was swept up into her life review and suddenly there were things she did during our marriage that were blocked from me. I think I'd get paranoid about those panels. What was being hidden from me? And yet, no one who has had the experience, at least no one in this book, felt threatened or betrayed by the missing information. They were being made to explicitly understand that something was being intentionally withheld from them, but came away with a deep sense of peace and satisfaction about the entire process. Odd. The third aspect of the shared death experience that stands apart from NDEs is the frequent, almost predictable reference to electricity. Quote, I felt a jolt, a vibration, like when you stick your finger in a socket. Or, quote, the information came like some sort of electrical discharge. What is the significance of electricity when it comes to what happens to us after we die? Strange interactions with electricity are central to many UFO experiences. And ghosts and poltergeists seem particularly obsessed with electronics. For example, turning lights and appliances on and off. And don't even get me started on EVP, electronic voice phenomenon. What's going on here? What's the connection? Ladies and gentlemen, these are the thoughts that keep me up at night. Glimpses of Eternity was waiting for me in my mailbox when I got home from work on July 27th, 2011. I remember the date very clearly because I was getting home early. And I was getting home early because I had just been fired. The show I was getting fired from was called Secret Circle, and the firer was Kevin Williamson. If the name sounds familiar, it's because he is the creator of the Scream movies. I guess if you're going to get fired, it might as well be by a person with some marquee value. As I came to learn, I was not the first person ever to be fired by Kevin Williamson, nor was I to be the last. And full disclosure, it wasn't my first time being fired, nor would it be my last. When you're fired from a show, you leave immediately. I always like to swing through the writer's room, let them know what's happened, see the shocked, devastated expressions, say a quick, heartfelt goodbye, and then take myself out to lunch. Usually I get fired in the morning. I didn't bother packing up my office. I could come back on Saturday morning when no one was around and do that walk of shame alone. So after saying goodbye, I walked straight to my car, pulled out of the spot that still had my name on it, and drove away from the offices with the vaguely giddy feeling that I'd just been given my summer back. You see, for me, the first direct result of being fired is an overwhelming sense of relief. It's like the feeling you get after throwing up. You know how it is? You're not feeling good, then you start to feel bad, then you feel really bad, and then it gets worse. You're afraid it's going to happen, then you're afraid it's not going to happen. But once it finally does, you tend to feel much better. All of that pretty much describes my last 2 months at Secret Circle. I headed down Gower to Melrose and straight to Osteria La Buca. I'm not really a wine guy, but I was that day. The house red was served in what looked like a miniature mason jar. I sat at my table alone, staring out the window into the street, sipping my wine, watching people go to and from what I assumed were the jobs they still had. My body was vibrating faintly, like a gong that had been struck. I felt simultaneously like I had been hit by a car, and also like I had narrowly avoided being hit by a car. As these complicated and conflicting feelings settled into a sort of numb middle ground, I started in on my plate of wild boar bolognese. The exhilaration was wearing off. What was left was the simple pleasure of the end of pain. 2 days later, I was sitting in my backyard reading Glimpses of Eternity and enjoying the smell of kerosene and cooked meat from my neighbor's yard when my agent called. He told me that even though I'd been fired, my contract called for a payout, which took the immediate fear of poverty away. But the studio that owed me the money, Warner Brothers, had a proposal. Would I be willing to earn some of the payout by writing a pilot for them? After all, it was the middle of summer. There was still plenty of time to get something going at one of the networks. My agent told me it was the civilized thing to do. Plus, writing a pilot would put me back at the beginning of a process that I'd gotten used to and liked. Pitching a pilot to the networks in the summer, writing it in the fall, and hoping it would be filmed in the spring. I agreed to the idea instantly. I wasn't just being a good sport. After 3 years of work experience that ricocheted from horrible to glorious and back to horrible with no middle ground, I was hoping for something glorious again. I was due for it, wasn't I? True, I didn't have any ideas, and after Secret Circle, I was feeling creatively and emotionally drained. But the dark times were all behind me now. Somewhere beneath the charcoal and the roasting hot dogs, I could smell redemption drifting in the wind. What do I want to write? What do I want to write? What do I want to write? I sat at my desk and stared at my bookshelf. That was usually a good place to start, but I'd been staring for an hour and nothing was happening. I thought about a conversation I'd had with Jane Espenson at Comic-Con just last month. Jane is a writer too, and we were sitting in the lobby of the Hilton Bayfront Hotel, and she was telling me about the pilot she had just sold to HBO. She was so excited about writing this particular idea, so happy. And I remembered listening and feeling so unhappy. Not for her, for me. I was still stuck in the job I was about to get fired from. I asked her how she did it. I mean, back then, selling a pilot to HBO was a big deal. She smiled at me and said, like it was the most obvious thing in the world, "Don't think about what they want. Pitch what you want. Just focus on pleasing yourself." She was right, of course. And in my case, I already knew I was going to get paid no matter what, so there was no desperation, no, "I gotta sell this or go hungry." I had the ultimate luxury of no consequences. All I had to do was come up with an idea that I loved and pitch it. So I did. The idea wasn't based on Jacques Vallee's book, The Invisible College, E.F. Dutton and Company, 1975, but it was sort of inspired by it. The phrase invisible college referred to a real thing. A small group of international scientists and researchers, Vallee among them, working under the radar to unravel the questions surrounding UFOs and alien encounters. The invisible part is key. Their work had to be done silently and in the shadows due to the wider attitude toward UFO phenomenon in the scientific world. If it was found out that any of these luminaries were also taking a serious look at the UFO question, they would risk losing academic and financial backing for their work. They might even be fired. And they would definitely risk having their careers and reputations destroyed by their more conservative peers who felt that UFO sightings were irrational bullshit. You know the type. But I found the notion of scientists being secretly involved in esoteric studies deeply appealing. I came up with an idea about a clandestine group that by day loudly ridiculed the very idea of the supernatural, a real skeptic society kind of thing. But the joke is, by night, they totally know all the stuff is real and poses a distinct threat to mankind, and they're working like crazy to figure things out, while at the same time trying to convince the world at large to look the other way, basically to give them time and space to deal with the problem on their own terms. I thought it was a fun notion for a supernatural show, a gentle poke at debunkers, and an irresistible opportunity to write about what it's like to lead a double life. It wasn't much, but it was an area and a tone that I liked, and it clearly played into my wheelhouse. I was excited. What I loved most about the idea is that to me, at its core, it was a show about human frailty and hope. It was about people being forced to accept a reality that was antithetical to what they believed. In my head, skeptics were always the enemy. But in this show, they became sympathetic heroes because their challenge would be so personal. It felt human and humane, funny and ironic, and ultimately, I knew I could fill it with light and love and hope. I spent most of August playing around with the idea, and just playing in general. I really had gotten my summer back. Instead of being locked in a miserable, stress-filled writer's room until, and I'm not kidding here, 3 in the morning, I was suddenly sleeping in, working a couple of hours a day at most, and then reading books in the backyard until the kids got home from camp. We went to Disneyland that summer. We took a road trip to San Francisco. We went out to movies. And the utter non-stress of it all, compared to what I'd been feeling before I got fired, was exhilarating. This is the way true creativity flourished. This is how it was supposed to be. Somehow, getting fired from Secret Circle was turning out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. Raymond Moody was only 30 years old when his first book, Life After Life, was published. Up until then, he'd spent most of his life in school. He received a PhD in philosophy and then went on to complete medical school and a residency in psychiatry. But all during that time, he was collecting stories of what he would later call near-death experiences. And once Life After Life became a bestseller, it freed him up to devote himself full-time to the study of what happens at the borderline between life and death. For nearly 20 years, Moody wrote and lectured on near-death topics, but always one step removed, always from the perspective of an armchair expert. Then, in 1994, something extraordinary happened. Raymond Moody had a shared death experience of his own. According to Moody, it was just after Mother's Day when his mom complained of a rash breaking out on her arms. A visit to the dermatologist the following day resulted in devastating news. Mrs. Moody had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and was given 2 days to 2 weeks to live. The Moody family all convened in Macon, Georgia, the following day, and for the next 2 weeks, they all stayed with their mom, making her final days as comfortable as possible. On the 14th day after diagnosis, exactly 2 weeks, Mrs. Moody suddenly sat up after being more or less comatose for 48 hours and loudly announced in a clear, lucid voice to everyone in the room that she loved them all very much. It was so shocking that Raymond's sister Kay actually asked her to repeat what she just said, which she did. It was so extraordinary that it gave everyone there a lift of what turned out to be false hope that she might somehow be recovering. But just a few minutes later, something even stranger happened. In Moody's words, quote, "As we held hands around her bed, the room seemed to change shape, and 4 of the 6 of us who were there felt as though we were being lifted off the ground. I had the feeling that the room had turned into the shape of an hourglass. I felt a strong pull like a riptide that was pulling me out to sea, only the pull was upward. Look," my sister said, pointing to a spot at the end of the bed. "Dad's here. He's come back to get her." Everyone there reported later that the light in the room changed to a soft and fuzzy texture, like looking at a light in a swimming pool at night. As all of this took place, there was great joy in the room. We all knew something truly incredible had happened to all of us as our mother died. It was as though the fabric of the universe had torn, and for just a moment, we felt the energy of that place called heaven. In the days after the funeral, Moody and his sisters, their husbands, and his wife Cheryl all discussed what they had experienced. And it appears that it was a little different for each one of them. Everything happened in an instant. There was no time for mass hysteria or for one witness to lead the others. It happened quickly and then it was over. Each of them, it seems, participated in Mrs. Moody's transition from life to death in their own unique way. The one thing they all agreed on was the most surprising thing of all. What should have been one of life's most unhappy moments had suddenly become a cause for elation. Warner Brothers called me and set a development meeting for Tuesday, August 30th. I was excited to pitch the Skeptic Society, which is what my show was called at the time, and I had a sense of how the process would go. I'd give the general pitch, they'd have questions and comments, they'd add to it, help me shape it, and we'd work together to create a show we were all excited about. After all, this wasn't my first rodeo. But as it turned out, this meeting wasn't a rodeo, or if it was me getting roped. It began with 3 beaming Warner Brothers development executives. One of them held an enormous bound manuscript in her hands. It looked way bigger than a script. Was it a novel? Didn't matter. I was happy, feeling good. I wanted to stay in the zone and just focus on bringing them into my enthusiasm bubble about the Skeptic Society. They asked me how my summer was going. They apologized for what happened on Secret Circle and grinned and rolled their eyes and said, "You know how Kevin is." But of course I didn't. I barely knew him at all. They seemed excited, which I thought was good. But they seemed more excited than me, which I thought was strange. Why would they be more excited than me when they hadn't even heard my idea yet? What were they so excited about? My eyes went back to the enormous manuscript, and the reality of the situation started coming into focus. "Before we start, we just want to say that we're so excited to be developing a pilot with you. And we have something here, and it's just an idea, but it's a book and we're really excited about it. And we would love for you to take a look at it. Oh, okay. That's fine. Of course they have something. They're Warner Brothers. They're a big studio. They have access to all kinds of things. They own tons of IP or intellectual property. The thing they're holding in their lap, the thing they're excited about, is a book they want me to adapt into a pilot. Don't get scared, I think. Don't get freaked out. It might be something amazing. It might be filled with light and love. It might be exactly what you want to do. In the meeting room, I watched as the executive holding the manuscript lifted it so I could see its title. Then she announced the title anyway. I Hunt Killers. Okay. Little aggressive, but at least the person is hunting killers, right? That's what traditional good guys do. So yeah, cool. Maybe this was cool. Here's the idea, she said. Jasper Dent is the son of one of America's most notorious serial killers. As a child, his father involved him in all his murders. So from the time he was a little boy, his earliest memories were all about his dad murdering people in their house. So he's like an expert on how serial killers work because he grew up in the middle of it for years and years and years, which makes him invaluable to the FBI, who want his help hunting down modern serial killers now that he's all grown up. Cool. This could be awful. This sounds awful. This sounds like the exact opposite of what I want to do right now. But for some reason, they want me to do this awful, dark, terrible, awful thing. These thoughts flash through my mind in an instant. But while they do, I'm smiling and nodding and trying to wrap my head around what's happening. Wow, I say, that's crazy. I know, they say, right? I could feel my stress level rising, which is never good in a meeting. And I remembered something my hero Stephen J. Cannell once said, a rule about being a television writer, quote, never say no in the room. Nobody wants to hear no, he said. Not writers, not development executives, nobody. So I followed Stephen Cannell's advice and said what he used to say. Interesting. Let me take a look. They looked so happy, it almost made me sad. So, she said, is there something you wanted to tell us about? Any ideas? We really want to know where your head's at, what areas you're interested in right now. Now, I might be an idiot, but I'm not stupid. And the last thing I was going to do was pitch them my idea about the Skeptic Society. They clearly weren't in the mood to really hear anything right now. So instead, I said, you know what? I've got a few things, but let me take a look at this first. I was pretending to be swept up in their excitement, another pose I have found useful throughout my career. We chatted a little longer, and then we wrapped things up, and I was out of that meeting and back in my car in less than half an hour. But I didn't leave empty-handed. Now, I was the one carrying the 2-pound manuscript. As I drove home, I had time to think. The year 2011 was a dark time for television. Sociopaths were the order of the day. The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Dexter, Criminal Minds, American Horror Story, The Shield, Homeland, The Walking Dead, Sons of Anarchy, House. In Hollywood at the time, it was common knowledge that your best shot at selling a project was to describe your main character as, quote, the smartest guy in the room. What this meant was that your character was driven purely by intellect and instinct, unhampered by emotions, a human shark. Hollywood wanted leading actors who were immune to emotions because emotions made you vulnerable. They clouded your judgment and impaired your ability to win. And who wants that? Winning is everything. This was a notion Hollywood could really get behind. They wanted characters who acted like machines, not people. They wanted characters that acted like them. Now, is this what America wanted? Against all evidence to the contrary, I still believe that viewers wanted to see versions of their best selves struggling with problems that were dramatic and compelling, but at heart no different than their own. And they wanted to be given hope. In fact, that's what the pilot I had produced last spring had been all about. It was called Heavenly, and it was beautiful, and everyone loved it until they didn't, and it wasn't picked up to series. And that's when I ended up on Secret Circle. Was I wrong about what viewers wanted? Did it matter? I was the one who was going to have to write whatever I ended up writing. I decided not to even try reading the book until the weekend. We were heading out of town. Maybe that would help my mood. We spent Labor Day weekend at the Catamaran, the very same resort on Mission Bay in San Diego where my brother John and I came when we were kids. But that was a long time ago, and it was very different now. The vending machines were all gone, and the rooms had been completely remodeled. In fact, the entire grounds had been lavishly re-landscaped and upgraded to resemble a high-end tropical resort. The rusty swing set was gone, along with the giant dripping sewer pipe. Now the hotel featured a manicured beach with white sand and huge striped umbrellas running in uniform lines on either side of a completely rebuilt pier that was now home to fancy speedboats and easy-to-pilot mini-yachts. No garbage, no water fleas, no sagging cyclone fence, no rotting kelp. It would have to do. And if you must know, yes, I checked. No Playboy news rack either. I sat underneath one of those giant striped umbrellas and sipped on a Mai Tai and read, I Hunt Killers. Let me be clear. This is not a bad book. And its author, Barry Liga, is a great writer. But it's very dark. That's what it's supposed to be. And at that moment in my life, it was the exact opposite of what I wanted to spend my time thinking about. And there was another problem. As I read the book, I started to get angry. My mind kept going back to Heavenly. Heavenly had been a big, sweet piece of candy about an angel who becomes human, and I loved it more than anything I had ever written. It was a funny, hopeful, romantic comedy with tons of heart. It was dramatic without being dark, realistic without being cynical. It didn't flaunt pessimism, sadism, and human horror like lurid jewelry, as so many shows did. And it was hard not to feel like that's why it got killed. Why was it so hard to put something out there in the world that wasn't wrapped in barbed wire and leaking blood? I felt like I was being cornered into doing something I didn't want to do. Worst of all, I felt petulant and resentful. I was spiraling. But this time, I just pulled myself up out of my own nosedive. Jane Espenson had said, "Don't think about what they want. Pitch what you want. Just focus on pleasing yourself." I decided that's what I was going to do. This was my gig. If I didn't want to do I Hunt Killers, I didn't have to. I wasn't under contract to do it. This was just their opening salvo. And if I told them I wasn't interested, it wasn't like the deal was off. It was okay to say no. I set the book down next to me in the sand and took a deep breath and looked out across the bay. Owen trudged up to me looking hot and tired. Spencer and Dashiell were standing in the distance, staring at the bay, looking confused and bored.
Dad?
Yes, Owen?
It's getting kind of hot out here, and there really isn't anything to do, so I was wondering if we can go back to the room and watch Kiki's Delivery Service, which is a movie that's on the hotel's on request, and Dashiell can watch it too because it's safe for kids.
I understood about a third of what Owen was saying, but it was enough. A minute later, the three of them were walking back to the hotel room. "What's wrong with them?" I asked Susan, who was under the umbrella next to me. "Honey," she said, "it's fine. Everybody's allowed to have their own vacation." Maybe she was right. I downed the last of my Mai Tai and started making plans for another. I gazed out across the bright blue bay and tried to steal back a little of the optimism and excitement I'd been feeling for most of the past month. Maybe the future wasn't so dark after all. Maybe sometimes the news is all good. As if to seal the emotion, I reached into my bag, brought out Glimpses of Eternity, and dove back into hope. And to be honest, the stories in the book were doing a number on me. All of them so strange and yet so reassuring. I've said that of all the supernatural experiences that exist, the only one I've ever wanted to have was the near-death experience. It seems to have such a positive effect on the person having it. Now, for those of you who have listened to episode 4 of this podcast, the one about the book Dancing Past the Dark, you're probably saying, but Rich, what about bad near-death experiences? I know, but that's the thing about this book and Moody's stories about shared death experiences. None of them were bad. Sure, they all involved people sitting with a loved one at the very moment of death. That has to be hard. And while I've never been through that exact thing, I've been close enough. The night before my father died, my brother John texted me out of the blue and said, "Hey, I'm going over to Dad's to play cards. Want to meet me down there and have a drink?" I held up my phone to Susan and showed her the text. I was torn. I wanted to go, but I was also 52 years old and it was 8:30 at night. Susan said, "Oh, you should go." So I drove the 9 miles down to Monterey Park to the house I grew up in. I gave Champagne, my dad's caregiver, a big hug as I walked in. "John is very tired tonight," she told me. I walked through the house into the family room and saw my brother sitting next to my dad's bed, the bed he'd been in for almost a year. Hospice care had gone on longer than anyone had expected. My brother was dealing hands of blackjack to my dad, who could barely hold the cards, but had no trouble adding up the numbers. He didn't speak, just made the accepted Las Vegas gestures for hit or stay. I joined in the next hand, and we all played for about 15 more minutes before my dad set his cards down and said, "All right." And that meant he was done. We each kissed him on the forehead and said goodnight, and that was it. The next morning, Champagne called to tell us he was gone. Nothing supernatural happened surrounding my dad's death, just the happy coincidence that John and I were there on the final night of his 89-year visit to Earth. Less than 12 hours later, we were both back at his bedside staring down at his dead body, and I gotta say, he didn't look much different. Then John did the most unexpected thing. He started doing his imitation of my dad. Pretty soon we were both laughing. I think in a small way, we were both a little bit relieved. His death had not been painful or traumatic. It had been very peaceful. He was here, and then he was gone. And we had gotten through it together. It hadn't driven us apart, as the long, lingering death of a parent can sometimes do to siblings. We had taken care of him and made sure that his last two wishes came true. He didn't want to be in pain, and he didn't want to leave his house. We had done everything we could for him, and now it was over. Not exactly a tunnel of light or a life review or a trip to heaven, but we made it through. And now we were goofing around over my father's corpse. I just hope my kids do the same with me when my time comes to go. Moody's book doesn't offer a lot of accumulated academic information about shared death experiences because there isn't any yet. The stories are still too few and far between. But I think this is the very reason he decided to go ahead and publish it anyway. To get the stories out there, to put the experience into the larger conversation, and maybe draw people out who thought they were the only ones who had ever experienced this strange phenomenon, and therefore felt isolated and alone. To me, what is so important about these stories is that they bring anecdotal evidence to the next level. These are spontaneous events that happen in everyday surroundings to normal people who are healthy, conscious, completely awake, and not under the influence of anesthesia or other life-saving or pain-killing drugs. Why is this so important? Well, because the entirety of the debunker's theories about near-death experiences are always tied to the possible physical causes. Some of you may have heard of the dying brain theory. This is a favorite of British debunker Susan Blackmore. The notion here is that when a dying brain is deprived of oxygen, it will begin to create hallucinations in the mind of the dying person. Those hallucinations could theoretically include seeing a bright light, having the sensation of traveling through a tunnel, and even a possible out-of-body experience. The only problem with this theory is that there is absolutely no proof or evidence to back up any part of it, and it also doesn't fit most of the cases in which near-death experiences occur. I bring it up now because, as weak an explanation as it is for a near-death experience, as you can see, it is totally useless in terms of explaining a shared death experience. Another great thing about the shared death experience? It's shared. NDEs are experienced alone, but SDEs involve at least two people, sometimes more. These stories gave me reassurance that even in the darkest moments in life, one could find hope and grace and joy. I waited a full week before calling the junior executive at Warner Brothers and letting her know that I Hunt Killers wasn't going to be right for me. And to my relief, there was not the slightest ripple of unhappiness or pushback. You don't want to do it? Don't do it. The next question was, did I have something I wanted to pitch them? Yes, I did. Great. Later that day, her assistant emailed me with some times to set a phone call. Not another in-person meeting, a phone call. Okay, that was fine. No problem. We set it up for later that week. I don't get it. That was from the head of the development team. I'd only given them a short pitch for the Skeptic Society, but I figured it was enough to get them interested, or at least to understand more of the kind of thing I was excited about doing. I figured they'd at least pretend to be interested and maybe ask some questions. Then I could get into more detail about the characters, episode structure, that sort of thing. But no, just, I don't get it. How can you respond to a statement like that without sounding defensive? Was I supposed to ask what part of it they didn't get? Was I supposed to just repeat what I pitched, only louder? It's a brilliant rhetorical strategy. There really is no adequate response. I clearly wasn't dealing with amateurs. I did the only thing I could think of, which was to just forge ahead and talk about what it was about the tone and the theme and the character challenges in the idea that I liked. When I was done, there was silence on the line. And again, I don't get it. The executive then addressed a question to her development team. Am I missing something here? This just doesn't sound like a show. She sounded almost angry. It was time to bail. Okay, I said, maybe we should move on. I've got a couple of other ideas. I actually didn't. Or maybe you guys have other stuff for me, other books or... One of the junior executives jumped in. We can definitely send you our open writing assignments. Let me get on that. And then you call us back when you've had a chance to take a look. Okay, great, I said. And we hung up. It wasn't the worst phone call I'd ever had with a studio, but it was in the top one. September became a month of frustration and resentment, which for me also meant fear, depression, and shame. Once a week, for the next 3 weeks, I got on the phone with Warner Brothers and pitched them three more ideas, each one less developed than the last, but each one with a concept, a main character, and a theme that I loved. Each was greeted with a version of the same, I don't get it. It began to feel personal. The confusion and impatience on the other end of the phone became more palpable every week. These people hate me, I thought. They hate me for failing them on Secret Circle, and they hate me for pitching them ideas that are not dark. They hate the fact that they owe me money and that they have to work with me when they so clearly don't want to. In short, they hate me. But for all of September, I hated them back. I hated them for allowing Kevin Williamson to fire me. Not that I wanted to be back in the middle of that tornado, but still, I hated them for not appreciating what I brought to the show. I hated them for not standing up for me. And I hated how they refused to engage with me, how they shut down every single notion I brought their way without a single question or suggestion. They were the ones who had asked me to write a pilot for them, so why were they shutting me down so hard? The worst part of it all was that I felt isolated. It was me against them.
I needed someone on my side. I needed an ally. I needed Jane Espenson. I was teaching my UCLA class that fall, and so I invited Jane to be my guest speaker the first week of October. After class, we went out for drinks, which I definitely needed. But what I really needed was for her to hear me complain about Warner Brothers and then tell me that I was right and they were wrong. Most of all, I needed to hear her repeat her mantra, "Don't think about what they want, pitch what you want." I needed to hear there was no reason to spiral, no reason to give up. That when things seemed darkest, dive even deeper into the pool of creativity and swim for the depths and come back with a glowing pearl. We sat in the bar at the W Hotel in West Beverly Hills. I had a martini. She had an amaretto sour. As we drank, I poured out all my misery, bitterness, and frustration. She listened calmly to my litany, and when I was finished, she said, "Why don't you just do it?" "Do what?" I said. "Write the pilot for I Hunt Killers," Jane said. "That's obviously what they want you to do, so just do it." What the fuck? Was Jane actually suggesting I do the exact opposite of what she told me to do last summer? "No," she said. "Just find something in it you love and make it about that." This sounded like a rationalization, like she was telling me to hold my nose and swallow my medicine. Or as William Goldman would so inelegantly say, put a bag over its head and do it for old glory. I started whining that my soul would shrivel and die if I had to spend the next 3 months writing a pilot about an emotionally abused kid who grows up to discover that he's a natural-born serial killer. That's when her eyes lit up. "Ah, but that's not what it's about. It's about a kid who doesn't want to be a serial killer, but is afraid he has no choice." I wrapped up drinks fast and paid and left. I drove home in silence. I was in a terrible mood, and the throbbing core of my bad mood was centered on one undeniable fact. Jane was right. Technically, she was 100% correct, which meant my problem was solved. So why was I still so fucking angry? I couldn't get at it. I couldn't see it. It's like it was paneled off. What was it I couldn't see? Whatever it was, I was the one holding the panel, not some spiritual being or angel of light. An angel of light. His name was Dashiell Coffey. He was the angel of light. He was the reason I couldn't move forward. The anger I'd been feeling was just another panel, paneling off my grief. He was the lead character in Heavenly, my pilot that had died. It died on May 17th, less than 6 months ago, and it was suddenly becoming clear to me, like some force inside my body, that I had never mourned it. Heavenly was all about love and hope and light. It was funny and romantic, and it deserved to live. But the network had passed. I had accepted the news like the professional I was, and within 4 days, I was hired back by the same network that killed Heavenly to run Secret Circle. Get over it. Get over it. Get the fuck over it. So I did. But I didn't. And it was fine. But it wasn't. I pulled off the freeway. I knew what was going to happen, I just didn't know exactly where. It turned out to be a Jack-in-the-Box parking lot on Crenshaw. I parked, and I took a deep breath, and I cried. It started out pretty weak, just a sort of wheezing sound. But I got there. Boy, did I get there. I had to focus on it because I knew this was it, my one chance, and it would be so easy to go numb again, or worse, let anger get in the way. Do it now or you never will. The thing that finally really got me going was remembering this one moment from the pilot. Not from the finished cut or from a day on the set or even a day writing the script. It was earlier than all of that, the day before the network pitch, more than a year ago.
Now, up until that moment, I'd only been referring to the main character, the angel, as our guy. That day, I was on the phone with my producing partner, Ross Feynman, and he said, "Rich, we gotta give our guy a name." And he was right. Our first pitch was the next day. We spent the next few minutes tossing out names to each other, and I hated them all. They all sounded phony. Then Ross said, "How about Dashiell?" Dashiell, of course, is the name of my third son, and at the time, he was only 3 years old. It was so obvious, so clear, so beautiful, and so perfect. I think I literally saw a flash of white light, but no, the room did not change shape. "Ross," I said, "let's name all the characters after our kids. In fact, you know what? Let's only put things into this pilot that we love." So, our angel became Dashiell Coffee, the phoniest name that's ever existed, but I didn't care because I love Dashiell and I love coffee. Owen and Spencer found their way into the script, and Ross's daughter Lily became the name of our female lead. We set the show in San Francisco. I made sure that Dashiell Coffee loved Oreos and dogs and Mai Tais. In the course of that one phone call, we changed names, locations, and scenes. But most important, we made a promise to ourselves. Whenever a question came up, whenever there was a decision to be made, we'd answer it with love. We just kept leaning into what we loved. And it worked. It became our lucky charm. And it illuminated the soul of the entire project, from script to casting to set design to props to costumes to editing to music to everything. And then 10 months later, the whole thing died, and I moved on without so much as a backward glance. I paneled it, and it had fucked me up ever since. Crying never lasts as long as you think. I felt like I'd been in that Jack-in-the-Box parking lot sobbing for half an hour, but when I looked at the clock, it had been less than 5 minutes. I texted Ross then and there and invited him out to dinner later that week to specifically celebrate and remember everything we had accomplished on Heavenly. And when I got home, I emailed the cast and the director and thanked them again for working so hard to make something so beautiful. And then I collapsed into the best sleep I'd had in months. The next morning, I woke up and wrote 9 pages of notes on I Hunt Killers. The suspense in the book is at the reader's expense to a large degree. We don't know what's inside Jasper Dent's mind. And it's clear we're always supposed to be suspicious of him and his true motives. Is he lying about his true mental state? Is he suddenly going to kill someone? Is he truly a killer? What Jane suggested made me realize there was a different way to go. What if we put Jasper and the audience on the same side? No games. What if he's worried about the same thing we're worried about? What is he truly capable of? Does he have a choice? What if it's about a kid who's afraid that tomorrow, out of nowhere, the hideous desire to kill will finally erupt inside him, like the curse of the werewolf or cancer? What if it's a story about a guy who desperately wants to believe he's good but can't get over the fear that deep down inside he's bad? Damn, the Richard Haddam story. Yeah, that was something I could write. Suddenly, the story was mine. By that Friday, I was absolutely sure I could find my way through the story on my own terms. So I called the junior executive at Warner Brothers and asked her to set another phone call, this time for I Hunt Killers. I pitched my version of I Hunt Killers to the executives at Warner Brothers the following week. They loved it. And that was fine with me, because by then, so did I. Moody's book is full of hope, but the moments of hope and transcendence he describes are happening at times of unspeakable loss. I realize now that joy and heartbreak are always connected, interlocked, and inextricable from each other. I've spent so much time in my life trying so hard to block out the pain and the sadness the fear and the loneliness, the darkness. Just focus on the good stuff, I tell myself, like that's going to save me. But there's a flaw in that thinking, because there is no up without down, no day without night. That's what was paneled off, what I couldn't see, because I refused to look. I was afraid it would be too painful, but avoiding it hurt way worse. Sometimes, finding the light means facing the dark and going through it, and trusting that eventually you'll make it to the other side. Thank you for joining me for Season 2 of Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Please join us on April 25th for the premiere of Season 3. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.